Hello, this is Louise. I just want to explain what happened at the end of this podcast. After we'd finished recording, Samuel Barker, one of the lawyers that I interviewed, offered to make a free submission to ICSA pro bono work, whereby he would put a group claim together to try and leverage ICSA into considering Jehovah's Witnesses as a separate case in their investigation. And what he said we would need is he would draft a submission for the hearing and he would circulate it so that anyone who was interested could sign it in a petition-like form. He also suggested that anyone who had a specific grievance, for instance, abuse, could have a private submission annexed on and he would be willing to put all that together. He suggested that we needed about 10 people to put forward grievances. So please, if you are willing to add your name with a specific grievance, so it would be anonymous to anyone else apart from Samuel, who's obviously putting the submission together, would you please contact me either via Facebook through my Facebook profile Louise Good, or you can email me on lougood@hotmail.com. that's LOUGOODE @hotmail.com, and I will try and get together as many people as possible so that we can put a really powerful submission from a really good London law firm to ICSA to try and get them to consider Jehovah's Witnesses as a separate case, which is something that we've been pushing for quite some time. This is an incredible opportunity from an experienced lawyer, and I'm sure that you will now enjoy listening to the podcast and hearing what Samuel and his colleague have got to say. Thank you.
Welcome to JW Community Podcast, where my mum is basically blabbering on about nonsense.
Thank you,
Phil.
Hello and welcome to another JW Community Podcast. I have got two guests with me today in my house, two lawyers from the law firm Hugh James. First of all, I've got Alan Collins.
Thank you.
You are the director for the association, you are a director for the Association of Child Abuse Lawyers, and you've acted in lots of really high profile cases that people will have heard of for the victims of people like Jimmy Savile, the Stuart Hall, Cyril Smith, Max Clifford, many others, the whole, I can't pronounce this, Odegaren,
yes.
Thank you. And so welcome to,
thank you very much,
to my podcast, and thank you so much for being interviewed. I've also got Samuel Barker, who's an Australian qualified solicitor who currently specialises in sexual abuse compensation. Now, Hugh James is a law firm in London, and it's a firm that you really need to have heard of if you at all think you've got a case or if you know anybody that has a case. So I'm going to kick off then. Alan, can you tell me what your background is that led you to working in this area?
Well, I got into it not through making a deliberate decision to do so. My background was a criminal lawyer, prosecution and defence work. So prosecuted and defended all sorts of cases, including child abuse cases. Mm. And one day when I was at court, a gentleman came up to me, who I didn't recognise, never met before, and he said, "What do I do now?" And I thought, why are you asking me this question? But basically, to get to the point, he had been a witness in another case. He had been a victim of child abuse, and he had given evidence against his abuser. The prosecution was successful. The abuser had been convicted and sent to prison. And this gentleman was actually asking a very simple, literal question, "What do I do now?" And what he was saying was to me, "How do I rebuild my life?" Because my life had been turned upside down through the police approaching me at home one night, the knock-knock on the door. "Were you at so-and-so school?" "Yes, I was." "Oh, can we talk to you?" And his life was literally turned upside down. He lost his family, he lost his house, he lost his job. So he was saying to me, "What do I do now?" And that was the very first case that I had where I was acting for a victim who needed to pursue a civil claim to get compensation so he could rebuild his life. And it just grew from there. And these days I look after survivors all over the place, whether it's in the UK, Australia or elsewhere.
That is such an important perspective, because some of the criticism I come across in civil cases is people say, "Oh, they're only doing it for the money." that puts the whole background as to why it's essential and not just a...
Yeah, and it's very unkind, if not cruel, when people go and say that because they don't know what they're talking about. If you know, they're more often not, they've got no kind of experience of what the survivor has been through. And I always use the analogy or the example, which is, well, if you were at work and there's an accident at work and you lose your leg and you can't work again, are you going to say, oh no, I'm not going to claim compensation? Of course you're not, because you're going to be what you'll want compensation for your lost leg and your inability to work. And survivors, in many ways, are no different to that person. Their injury is to them internally, and they are entitled to be compensated in just the same way. Very often, they need to rebuild their lives. They need maybe treatment. They may need to have to pay for therapy. They may have loss of earnings. They may have lost out on education as a result of the abuse. And they want to get into education. They want to get qualifications. It all has to be paid for. And that's what compensation is all about. Compensation is there to try as best as possible to put things right. It's not a lotto win. It's not a raffle. It's about justice. It's about trying to put things right.
Sam, can I ask you the same question? How you ended up working in this area?
No problem. Well, actually, I started around 6 years ago. I started working in this area of law through volunteering with an organisation called Commission of Inquiry Now in Melbourne, which was run by a very senior QC in Melbourne named Dr. Brian Keon Cohen, who, just as an aside, did the Mabo cases years before. And he had effectively set up a volunteer organisation to assist in writing submissions to the Royal Commission. And I was put on assisting the submissions in relation to limitation. And, you know, looking into that area in Australia, limitation was still the law, i.e. you would be out of time you know, years after the fact. And looking into it, I found out quite an unfair situation. And, you know, I found the law around it quite interesting as well. And that was my first, you know, exposure to that. I was admitted, qualified in 2014 in Melbourne. I was actually working in insurance litigation on largely the defendant side and wasn't doing any of this kind of work until later on. So I was doing a whole range of things, asbestos, you know, just general slip and trip kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
And I came across a case where I was acting for the state of Victoria, quite different than what I do now when I'm acting on the claimant side, which was a large case involving a teacher at a school and child sexual abuse. And I was working on that case for around a year. And then decided to move to London and wanted to come over onto the claimant side to do, you know, basically the other side of that kind of work. And looking online, I found Alan, and the rest is kind of history in a way. I moved here at the start of this year and started doing this kind of claimant work. It's been a great experience so far, and I've had great exposure here in England working for Alan and Hugh James.
And also, I mean, the Royal Commission was a world standard, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You worked on the best.
I wasn't working on the Royal Commission. I was working as a part of a volunteer organisation who
but just
was
being,
writing to it. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And yeah, it is the gold standard, really. And, you know, reading through, relevant to this podcast, of course, their report into the Jehovah's Witness in Australia is obviously something that really needed to happen. And it's a great thing.
So one of your recent cases was regarding Douglas Slade, which when Sam first contacted me, said we've just had like a groundbreaking case. Can you explain to me why that was such a groundbreaking case?
Because children, young people on the other side of the world from England, in the Philippines, have been sexually abused by Slade, and they brought their own case against him here in London and succeeded. And that's a first. This is the first time that child victims of sexual abuse have actually been able to sue their British abuser in a British court and get justice.
That's incredible. I know some of the cases that I'm aware of in the XJW community have involved elders and Jehovah's Witnesses who've been abusers who have moved to several different countries. And part of the reason why they probably haven't reported for 30, 40 years is they've just thought, well, it's ancient and it's gone and they've moved country. But obviously you're managing to work on those problems and pick them.
One of the big issues is that survivors, victims, are often totally unaware of their legal rights. That is a big, big issue. Mm. No one really makes an effort to explain to survivors what their options are, what their legal rights are. It is astonishing. Here we are in 2019 and people are not aware. And one of our jobs is to try and make sure that they do become aware so that they can make an informed choice, as these young people in the Philippines were able to. Through a charity in the Philippines that was working with them, that information was passed on to them and they were able to make that informed and conscious decision about bringing their own case, because had they not had that information, nothing would have happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I keep on doing the podcast, because I just want to give people that kind of information. I was involved in a totally different situation, something that needed reporting to the police recently. And I didn't want to do it because in my mind I thought, how do they know I'm not lying? It's just my word against the other person. And even that thought, even with all the work I do telling other people to take things to the police, when it came to me, I just thought, oh, well, I could have just made this up. So what's to stop? And that really put me off reporting.
Sure.
So you're right, people don't know the legal rights.
Mm.
So are you able to explain then the kind of situation that would make Watchtower Society liable in an abuse case rather than just the person who's abused you?
Well, again, this is from the English perspective.
Yes.
And obviously the situation is somewhat different in Australia and certainly in America. I can't really comment on how it is there. Certainly there are cases in America that have been successful against Watchtower.
Mm-hmm.
But here in England, there's effectively two ways to do that. And the main way is through what's called vicarious liability.
Mm-hmm.
And vicarious liability is essentially a form of direct liability where the organisation, i.e. the congregation, is liable for the acts of elders or ministerial servants or people who are put in a position of power. Exactly.
Yes.
And in that kind of case, you don't have to prove negligence. You need to prove that basically there is a relationship between the organization and the abuser, which will give rise to vicarious liability, and that within the confines of that relationship, the abuse was performed. And it's a two-stage test you have to make out, and both of those stages involve a lot of different requirements, and it's rather complicated. But the bulk of cases that involve the church and Jehovah's Witness, indeed, are on the basis of vicarious liability. And the second form is negligence. Negligence involves there being a duty of care owed from the congregation or Watchtower itself to the members, and there being a breach of that duty of care. Again, that's kind of simplifying it, but they're the two ways essentially that liability will be made out between where you can seek justice for something that's happened to you. And again, as I said, the position's different in Australia and America, but largely speaking, that's how it is here in England.
That sounds quite positive to me, because I had a misunderstanding about why Watchtower would be liable. And my misunderstanding, based on what you just said, was that if an abuser had been reported before,
mm-hmm.
and then what the elders and also Watchtower were aware of that person but had not done anything, and then that abuser went on to abuse someone else, my understanding was that like the other person could say, well, you already knew about him. But that's not necessarily, you can take it back to that first case of abuse
if
these two conditions apply.
Yeah, so what you're talking about isn't vicarious liability, that's a claim in negligence. You're saying that what the elders did with the initial complaint
was negligent.
Yeah, it was negligent, and that caused what later happened.
Now, if
we take the example of vicarious liability,
mm-hmm.
any kind of instance of abuse that happens within the Jehovah's Witness, within a congregation, if that abuse is committed by somebody in a position of power or even an ostensible position of power, i.e. they've been given some form of ability to lead sermons, mm-hmm. run Bible sessions, take out witnesses to door knock, etc. And within that kind of relationship, there is some sort of abuse committed.
Yeah.
Then that could be said to give rise to vicarious liability, for which the congregation should be liable.
Right.
So that's a different form of liability than negligence.
Did you find that you had to learn loads of stuff about the internal canonical law and the policies and procedures to get your head around all this?
Well,
was it straightforward?
It wasn't straightforward. luckily the Royal Commission had done a lot of that
work.
Yeah,
they've done loads,
And, you know, although that's specific to Australia, the report itself goes over the setup and the organisation worldwide of Jehovah's Witness and really runs through that in detail. You know, I've had to read through elders' handbooks and, you know, Watchtower publications, things like that, to give me an understanding of what the preachings are, you know, all of those kind of things. But largely speaking, to get grips of the structure for the purposes of vicarious liability, the structure of it was rather straightforward. From the top down, there is a hierarchical organization, and that itself was somewhat easy to understand.
Yeah, brilliant. The other thing the Royal Commission did that was interesting was they published some of their secret documents on their website, because I know Watchtower have pursued individual activists and taken their websites down based on copyright for publishing the same documents.
Yeah.
But obviously they're on the Royal Commission's website and they're not pursuing them, interestingly.
Yeah, they're on the Royal Commission's website, and you can look on the website and go to the evidence that was submitted, and it's listed there. And I was looking through some of it yesterday, which were internal letters written to elders about how to deal with abuse. And again, you know, the thing that you see coming through strongly is adherence to this two witness rule that, you know, is doggedly prescribed, adhered to, despite what now the Royal Commission has said. But you can look at those documents. Indeed, even in the English case, the important English case in 2015, which held Watchtower to be vicariously liable for the abuse of a survivor in that case. Mm-hmm. Some of the documents referenced in that judgment and about how elders are supposed to deal with abuse, and it shows that it was a live issue even for years.
With the documents on the Royal Commission's website, so for instance, elders' letters written from the organisation to elders tend to have their country address on. So does that make it difficult if you're doing a case in England and I say, oh, hey, I've got this letter written to elders in Australia saying how to deal with abuse, which actually I did come across one this morning. But it's not necessarily something you could use, is it? Because it's written to another country, even though different. I know that same letter will apply
everywhere. Yeah, you and I have actually spoken about that in the past, and I found it really helpful to know about that. A lot of the literature, the obviously directives that are disseminated, come from the governing body, obviously, which is in the United States.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't use it as direct evidence, but it assists in understanding how the organisation directs elders to deal with matters such as this.
Yeah, brilliant. So can you explain the process? If there's somebody listening and they think they might have a case against Watchtower, what is the process of approaching your firm?
Telephone, text, email, just get in touch.
Right.
It's very important, if you reach that stage, not to hold back, because whilst we understand it is a big step, it's a big ask to pick up the telephone or go online and send an email, whatever, experience has taught us that once you're in that position, you need to go ahead, otherwise it's going to eat at you.
Yes.
And talk to us. Conversations are always private, confidential. We don't charge for that initial conversation.
That's really interesting to know.
And we always like to meet.
Yes.
Because a face-to-face conversation is far more productive than trying to deal with things by emails or texts or phone.
I've seen more of England than I ever thought I'd see working for this firm coming from Australia at the start of the year. You know, I've been all over England to see clients.
So you travel? You travel to see people?
We go to Scotland. We went to Spain recently to see a client. You know, that was one of the things which was the biggest learning curve for me when I came to this country, and how these kind of matters are handled. That, you know, Hugh James is the firm that will go out and see clients where they are.
We do whatever works. So some people do want to come and see us in the office in London or Cardiff, but most prefer to have these conversations in a place where they feel comfortable, yeah. which is often their home. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be. Sometimes we arrange meeting rooms at mm-hmm. business centres or a hotel or wherever, mm-hmm. whatever works, because that is the most effective way of having that initial conversation.
And in terms of somebody that has got something that happened 30 or 40 years ago, would you say, what's the process there?
Is it absolutely the same? Yeah. You could talk to us.
Mm.
You know, we may, at the end of that conversation, have to say, sorry, but there isn't a case there. Mm. But on the other hand, it may be a position where we're able to say to them, yes, there is a case, and this is what you need to do.
Yeah, a lot of what I was talking about before in terms of the legal framework and how you would make the organisation liable,
mm.
I guess the shadow over all of that is limitation.
Yes.
And limitation is something people have to be aware of, and that is that you are technically meant to bring a claim from 3 years after the date that it occurred,
mm-hmm.
or, as in most cases, when this occurs, if the survivor is a child, 3 years after their 18th birthday, which is your 21st birthday, obviously. But under the Limitation Act, there is scope for the court to disapply the time limit, which means if they think a fair trial is possible, they can set it aside. But all forms of delay is taken into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, an initial report to police and then waiting years before you pursue your civil case could be fatal to a civil case. So, basing off what Alan was just saying then about, getting in touch, it is always limitation something that should be taken into account in that regard.
Sometimes survivors are sort of tempted to sit on the fence. And that's always, in my experience, unwise.
Mm.
Because, A, sitting on the fence, you can get a splinter where it might hurt. And, yeah, because it's eating away at you. Do I or don't I? Do I or don't I? You know, it's eating away. And if you then go on having sat on the fence for a long time to try and pursue a civil case, the court may say, well, what were you doing? You should have got on with this ages ago.
Mm.
Therefore, we're not going to allow you to proceed with the claim.
Mm.
So it comes back to the point that I've made at the beginning, which is if you arrive at the position where you're thinking, perhaps I want to do something, then you need to take it that next step, go on to that next stage and get advice. Mm. And then you can make an informed choice about what you want to do.
Yeah. Because typically the situation in a typical Jehovah's Witness abuse case is something happens when you're a child. You were born into the religion.
Mm.
You're brought up in it. Something happens in your childhood. You're either disfellowshipped as a teenager because you start living a chaotic lifestyle you're so damaged. Or you force yourself to stick with it for years and maybe fade out of the religion or leave as an adult. And then that's when you're able to confront it. I'm not aware of any active Jehovah's Witness that's ever brought a case against another active Jehovah's Witness. So that's, unless it's business, that's fine. You can bring what cases you like if it's doing money, but if it's abuse. So that accounts for quite a big delay.
Yes.
So there was one case where a lady went on holiday with her. She'd got grown up as a witness, got married as a witness, had children. They'd gone on holiday and she tried to kill herself. And then it all came out, yes. what her issue was.
Mm.
And so that tends to account for big delays.
Yes, which is all understandable, which the courts understand.
Yeah.
But the court will also be wanting to know, well, when it all came out, what did you then do about it?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a case of when you're sort of psychologically ready to face it, that's the time to go commit.
Yeah,
and this is why we obtain medical evidence in relation to that.
Yeah.
Why there was an inability to come forward earlier and whether a psychiatric state, mental effect from the initial abuse, which is entirely understandable, whether that was causative of the delay or inability to come forward.
Mm.
But one of the big issues, as Alan was saying, is once you come to that realization, long delays after that.
Yes,
can cause issues.
Yeah, if you sort of make a move and then you prevaricate for a long time, that's problematic.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, although the courts can seem rather harsh when they apply the law and don't allow a case to proceed, there is also an understanding of the reasons why people can't come forward.
Yeah.
And also, when you look at things like the Royal Commission that's, you know, heard all this evidence and particularly expert evidence and have distilled it into reasons why organisations like Jehovah's Witness have issues with these kind of abuse problems, it is because of this culture of shunning. And that's documented in the Royal Commission's report.
Yeah. Angus Stewart took up shunning quite well, I thought. He understood it. And it's a very hidden thing. So if you and I went to Tesco's now, there is a Jehovah's Witness that works at my local Tesco's. If we went through the till together, he would shun me, but you wouldn't notice it. But I'd feel it really keenly because you'd just think, oh, we're just putting this stuff through the till, but I'd be like keenly aware that I was being hidden in plain sight. So,
and anybody with half a mind could understand why there would be a delay in coming forward if you are born into an organization like that, your family, your friends, and you think if you're going to do something about this, everything you know is gone. You're going to be shunned. You know, it's not that difficult to understand why people then have a problem with reporting it, coming forward.
One of the other issues is Watchtower says, we don't discourage anyone from reporting, and, you know, it's really the parents' responsibility. If it's a child case, it's the parents' responsibility to report. Well, I could be mistaken, but isn't it not often a family or a family friend that is doing the abusing, so they're not going to report themselves? Or...
That's right. Certainly. So, absolutely. So whether we like it or not, a grim reality is that a child is often abused in a family setting. That's the way it is. I know it's a very uncomfortable fact, but that's how it is. So there's immediately problems for the child, the young person, from reporting anyway because of the circumstances. And survivors tell me that even when it is someone outside the family who's been doing the abusing, they find it very difficult to tell their parents anyway because they've got feelings of shame, guilt. They think they're going to get into trouble. They think it's their fault. Of course, it's not their fault, but that's how they feel. How abuse happens. And, you know, one of the reasons why abusers get away with it, because the victim, the survivor, is often the one who feels responsible, guilty, and so on, which are very powerful forces.
And often the abuser has groomed the family. I mean, that's what you do, right? If you're going to be an abuser, you'd make sure that everybody liked you first.
Very
common. You wouldn't come in like a comedy villain, would you?
Very common in religious settings that the abuser knows the family. And has got close connections with parents and so on.
So, is there any advice that you would give to people who think that they might have a case?
Go and get advice. Go to the police. You know, the police are very good. They are very experienced in dealing with these cases. It's very different to how it was maybe 20, 30 years ago. You know, you have specialists trained officers and teams and departments who deal with these sorts of cases. If you're unable to go to the police for whatever reason, get legal advice from a specialist lawyer. You know, there are the facilities and the means out there to help you, to give you the confidential advice and support that you need to make an informed decision about what you want to do.
I must admit, I found the police incredibly nice and helpful and supportive when I had to speak to them recently. Really different to what you'd imagine. I wasn't frightened of the police themselves as I might have been of other organisations like social services, terrifying me because of all the connotations in your head. But the police, they are amazing. Yes. They are really supportive and kind. So I'm guessing that the cases that you deal with Watchtower, is it possibly the same pattern with other religions? It's all much of a muchness with different details.
Similar patterns, similar circumstances, similar issues.
And of course, you've also dealt with a lot of cases with individual abusers, haven't you? Like these big names that I mentioned at the beginning.
Quite often, it's the cases that we bring against individuals are not famous people. They are famous persons. They are cases brought against maybe a father, an uncle, a relative. They are quite common cases, sadly, but that's the reality. So, yes, we bring civil claims against the abuser, father, whatever, to get compensation for the victim, for the survivor.
And that's another thing about obtaining expert advice about these kind of things. People might think, well, the person who did this to me, they're not worth suing. You know, they don't have something that this isn't going to be. I'm not going to be able to achieve a sense of justice out of this. But that's why legal principles like vicarious liability, you know, these kind of things that people might not necessarily take into account when they're thinking about, you know, what was the context of the abuse, all of those things. And that's why obtaining advice in relation to those issues is important.
So where a person might be thinking, there's no point me suing that individual, there might be an organisational aspect to it, because the organisation can be held vicariously liable.
And there's no harm in making a call to a solicitor on a confidential basis to speak about that, so you can understand what the options actually are.
Do you think going forward that Watchtower will be forced to change its policy and procedure on this? By sheer numbers of cases, or do you think they'll carry on entrenching?
Well, it's an interesting question. And I know that in Australia, Jehovah's Witness or Watchtower has been criticised in not properly, you know, taking on the Royal Commission's recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the people in power in Australia in the Watchtower organisation would say that's untrue. But in England, I think it would be worthwhile for the inquiry here to take a better look into the organisation, just like Australia did. As a lot of your listeners might not, some of your listeners might not know, in England there is an equivalent kind of Royal Commission, which is the Independent Inquiry into Child Sex Abuse. Mm. That's right. And I know that they've requested documents from Watchtower. Mm. The reason why that's been done is somewhat unclear, but I think it'd be worthwhile, and if there are going to be changes to the way the organisation deals with child abuse, it will come through that.
Mm. A lot of us have made submissions to ICSA, and indeed my podcast has encouraged people to go to ICSA and make their own submissions to try and leverage that, because I think what we felt was that they perhaps didn't have enough cases to justify including Jehovah's Witnesses separately. We were going to be included in or any other sort of category.
Well, it would need to be examined to understand why a culture of abuse was or is able to survive even in this modern day, and what kind of proper safeguarding steps can be implemented to make sure it doesn't happen again. We know that the Charity Commission here has, I think in 2015 or maybe since then, launched an investigation into Watchtower, which was then, there was a legal challenge to that.
Mm-hmm.
Looking online, even as recently as last week, there's nothing about what the Charity Commission's actually done.
Mm.
And this is, you know, 3 years on.
Yeah, and that's another one we've been trying to leverage and work with the Charities Commission on, because I agree there's some running in those investigations, but it's more, I'm not sure whether any one thing could effect change on its own, but the more people become aware and interested, and the more you can say you're being investigated by the Charities Commission, you're being investigated by ICSA, that does, it kind of develops more of a culture of what the witnesses are doing being unacceptable.
Mm. And of course, and also on a more basic level, which is often overlooked, people bringing claims, successful claims, actually costs the organisation money.
Mm.
And that can in itself be an effective route to bring about change.
Mm.
So organisations that are insured find that pressure is brought to bear by their insurers to change, because the insurers are saying, well, you know, we're having to pick up the tab.
Yes, that's interesting. This.
So what are you doing to improve your safeguarding practices? Because we don't want to find, as your insurer, in 10, 15, 20 years' time, another load of claims. So financial pressures are often behind the scenes a very effective way of bringing about change.
And are they insured? Or do we not? Would we know that? We wouldn't know.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know.
My own understanding is that they're not, but I could be.
That's my gut reaction, because they have an endless supply of cash from the sort of little funny little property. Yeah.
So they may be insured for some things, anyway, so I could be wrong, but that's my take.
That's my understanding.
Having an internal legal team would suggest that they do their own self-insured.
Yeah, they do have a big legal team in London, don't they? Do you have to speak to them then? I mean, when you're just doing your normal cases and whatever it is you're doing?
Yeah, well, we correspond with them.
Yeah. And are they all Jehovah's Witnesses, or do they employ, like, normal people?
That's a loaded question.
It's not loaded at all. There's Jehovah's Witnesses and there's normal people. I think you'll find.
I couldn't say. I think from the basis of the Australian Royal Commission report, again, I could be wrong. Mm. My understanding from reading that was that their solicitor for the Watchtower legal team is a Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah, he was, wasn't he? Yeah, and Australian guy.
So for using that as an example, perhaps that's the case here.
I think they've trained some in-house, which is a source of great grievance to me, because we weren't allowed to go ahead and get any education. But then if they need someone, if they want a solicitor, they'll put somebody through the training, which seems really harsh, because I've got good friends that are really intelligent, but are window cleaners. Because they've gone for years being a witness, and then by the time they've left, they've gone back to university, but there's no way they can change paths in the 30s or 40s.
Yeah.
So I know that they've said in another case, we will never change the two witness rule. And they said that on, they have a monthly broadcasting thing as well that the rank and file have to watch, and they've said that there as well, we'll never change the two witness rule. But I would imagine that, I know the quantum in England is a lot less than, say, in American cases, but I would imagine the financial pressure from firefighting in several different countries, lots of cases must eventually.
I'm sure it has a pressure, because they are an entity like any other entity. You know, do they really want to be spending their money on child abuse?
I don't know.
And having to sort out all the ramifications and implications? And thought they would, like any other organisation, think, well, actually, this money would be better spent elsewhere. Therefore, we ought to be taking steps to ensure that the risk of child abuse is reduced to the absolute minimum.
Yeah.
You know, it's common sense, isn't it? That's what you would have thought. But like other religious entities, they are going to find themselves in a position where they are not immune from pressures that are being brought to bear by society and government. Mm. You know, if you look at the Catholic Church in its broadest sense, arguably it could be said that it considers itself to be beyond, in some ways, national law. Mm. Of course, it isn't.
Mm.
And you've only got to look at the evidence that was given at ICSA in relation to how the Catholic Church in England functions to see perhaps where I'm coming from.
Mm.
So, you know, whether it's the two witness rule or any other particular rule that the Jehovah Witnesses may have, we'll find that it's probably not going to be tenable. Mm. Otherwise, they're going to be exposing themselves to potentially more cases, more shame, and more difficulties.
And the fact that there is a backlog of, you know, people don't report for a lot of years. So there's always going to be a sort of a 30-year delay. So they need, you know, even if they change now, they're still looking at mopping up that backlog.
Indeed.
Well, there's a lot of changes that need to happen. And quite aside from just the two witness rule is, you know, the organisation itself examining the veracity of a complaint from a child and looking at their background, and then looking at the background of the alleged abuser and making their own decision. It's not a decision that they should be making. That's a police decision.
Yes, that's right.
And it should never be the case that if a layperson is given evidence or accusations, that that person should be making a call as to whether that should be taken seriously. That just shouldn't happen.
Exactly. They're putting themselves as a first line filter before the police, and we'll decide whether there's a prima facie case before we go to the police. And that's not that's not the job of me or a plumber or a window cleaner or a builder. That's the police's job.
No, it's divorced from the real world. And it's also the point that I was trying to make just now. Divorced from civil and criminal law in many ways. Mm. You know, it's almost as if you think that you can actually do your own thing. You can't. Not in 2019. You can't in the 21st century.
That's such a good thing to hear, because you have hit the nail on the head. That is exactly how, and I remember being a witness, and we would say, well, God's law is all important and comes first. And if following God's law means disobeying man's law, then that's what we'll do. You're absolutely right. They do operate at a different level, as if actual law doesn't matter. And I think that thinking will have to change.
Absolutely.
As society develops.
Yeah. You need to be objective about things, and this is the problem. If you're the person who's, you know, if it's an elder of a congregation is given the task of deciding whether an allegation should be taken seriously, they'll largely know the person the allegation's made about, and they're all subjective opinions.
Yeah,
it doesn't take into account evidence objectively, and that's why you need the police to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I've said that it's. So one of the arguments against reporting to the police that I've heard, which I think is nonsense, is, well, what if the person's innocent? And I said, but that's the police's job. Reporting to the police is not a full-on guilt trip straight away. Reporting to the police is they have the skills and knowledge and training and ability to investigate, and then they decide guilt or innocence.
It's actually the end of the day, a court. You know, the police investigate, and they are the ones who decide whether there's enough evidence there in their opinion to justify, you know, matters being taken further. Mm. And a lawyer from the Crown Prosecution Service would have to decide whether there's sufficient evidence to charge and take a case to court. Mm. So there's all these checks and balances before a case ends up in front of a judge and jury.
So that's just not an argument at all.
Yeah, there's a lot more safeguards in place to ensure an innocent person doesn't go to jail than would be in place within the watchtower to prevent an abuser getting away with something they've done.
Yeah, absolutely.
So leaving it to the police is better.
That is so interesting to hear. I'm really grateful that you've come and explained all that. And I genuinely hope that more people come forward, because I think, apart from anything else, it is healing for people to be heard and listened to and believed. And I think my understanding is often when a survivor comes forward and speaks to a solicitor or a policeman or whoever it is that they choose to speak to, they say, it's the first time I've been believed. And
for many survivors, when they, at the end of their cases, they'll say to us, it was a cathartic experience. Mm. It may have been extremely difficult. And there may have been times along the way where they have thought, what have I started?
Mm.
Why have I done this? But having gone from the A to Z of that journey, they say, it was a cathartic experience. And for many, they'll say, I can now draw a line in the sand and actually move on in my life.
Mm. Yeah.
Because prior to doing all of this, they've stuck.
Yeah, no, definitely. Thank you so much for coming today.
Pleasure.
It's been a real privilege. And I'd just like to reiterate to everybody listening, these two gentlemen travelled from London to my house in Gloucester today simply to do this podcast. So if you do think that you have a case, please do contact them. And they, as Sam, you said, Hugh James is this firm that travels to meet people. Please speak to somebody and take your case forward, because it will be helpful and healing, and it'll help you move forward in your life. So thank you very much,
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Thank you so much.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to another JW Community Podcast.
And they are inside your head. You got a voice that says you won't get past this one. You won't win your freedom. It's like a constant war, and you want to settle that score, but your bruised and beaten, and you feel
heaviest heart. Put it in your past, oh, feel the winds are leaving. It's redemption season. Long live the young and high. Cheers to a brand new style. We're evolved and breathing to live a life of freedom. Oh, to everyone who's hit their limit, it's not over yet, it's not over yet. Yeah!